and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Monday, June 3rd, 2024. The U.S. Special Envoy for Sudan is calling on the international community to support local initiatives by young men and women to save life across towns in Sudan.
It's just all the more reason why the mutual aid efforts and emergency response rooms are so important. Is unfortunately in Sudan for many decades, we've seen this same playbook where armed groups will use starvation as a weapon of war.
And calm returns to Malakal after weekend's tension across the town.
We received around five casualties. Three, they were moderate cases, and two were severe cases. And those two severe cases, they passed on this morning.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The U.S. Special Envoy for Sudan is calling on the international community and allies of the United States to support efforts by young men and women in Sudan who are saving lives. Ambassador Thomas Pirellio says emergency response rooms created by Sudanese groups during the onset of the conflict in the country lacks the necessary support for averting the looming humanitarian crisis in the country.
Rather than simply being paralyzed by that tragedy, you saw these young people create a system for making sure to get food and support and medicine to those in the most fragile, hard-to-reach parts of Sudan. And it wasn't just going through the traditional humanitarian NGOs, though they have a very important role to play. It was based on people who understood the specifics of their country and their communities and what was needed. So creating cash apps and localized kitchens and other efforts. And it really just saved countless lives. And when later in the conflict, more and more barriers arose, no telecom, fewer and fewer commodities, rather than, again, move into a mode of paralysis, it was creativity and it was courage. What is the new way we can think about doing this? We want to see more international support to this, more attention on it, and that's why we appreciate you drawing attention to it today.
The situation in Sudan is, complicated by lack of access. For most people who like to intervene, how is that impacting on the efforts to reach out to these emergency response rooms?
It's just all the more reason why the mutual aid efforts and emergency response rooms are so important. Is unfortunately in Sudan for many decades, we've seen this same playbook where armed groups will use starvation as a weapon of war. They will use the shutting down of either borders or lines within the war, whether that's to subject people to horrific rents, threats, sexual slavery, other abuses. And this is an effort to really think more creatively using current technology about how we might do that differently. Now, it's true, it's hard to scale up the level of support needed to reach millions and millions of people. And so the international NGOs still have a very important role to play. We still need to see the military open up the borders to food and medicine and the RSF guarantee safe access. But even in the midst of that, we've seen these amazing, inspiring efforts really make a difference.
Let's talk about the Paris donor conference that was held, and there were lots of pledges. Did that really meet the expectations of the people of Sudan?
So there's good news and bad news. I mean, the good news is we substantially increased the pledges. The bad news is it started at such a pitifully low level that even those increases are needing to materialize more quickly. We are starting to see a difference in terms of food and medicine on the front lines of this conflict. We've been very clear that that needs to be actively forward deployed, whether that's into warehouses in Port Sudan or in Chad and other areas. Of course, we also have many refugees in parts of South Sudan and Kenya, Uganda, Egypt, where we've been able to get some increased support. So it is part of it, but that really needs to be the beginning, not the end of the conversation of making sure those pledges become more food and medicine and that they can reach the hardest hit areas. And again, part of that is where these non-traditional innovations can be part of that solution.
Let's look at the traditional, you know, toolbox of diplomacy. U.S. has been on record for dangling carrots and sticks. And of late, there were lots of sanctions slapped on both sides in the conflict in Sudan. How will that impact the move to really reach out those who are trapped inside South Sudan? I mean, inside Sudan, rather.
Well, we think it has been helpful, but it is not sufficient. I think we do know that sanctions have probably deterred some of the more aggressive attacks on al-Fashir and some of the atrocities and hate speech that we see. But obviously, we are nowhere close to conditions in Sudan that we would consider acceptable. We're seeing the horrific attacks on particularly women and children. We've seen the ethnic cleansing of the Mas elite. We continue to see starvation and other horrific conditions. So we are far, far from where we need to be. We need more countries to join us in those sanctions. But really, at the end of the day, we have to remember this was a man-made crisis. This is not a famine that was caused by a drought. It's not a famine that was caused by a disease that hit crops or by a terrible storm. This was an entirely man-made famine because of the decision of the SAF and RSF to go to war, because of the decision of the RSF to burn crops and loot warehouses, and now of SAF to limit humanitarian access when people are starving. So we need much more to be done. The sanctions will be part of it, and we will continue to increase the costs on those actors inside and outside of Sudan who are fueling this conflict. But ultimately, we want is for people to come to the peace table. We believe that table is set in Jeddah. We are looking for the commitments, particularly from SAF, to allow that to go forward, to answer any outstanding questions that are there, because we believe this is the path forward to peace. And that is really what we hear most often from the Sudanese people, is a need to silence the guns and ensure access to food and medicine.
That's Ambassador Thomas Perelio, the U.S. Special Envoy for Sudan. He spoke with me on Friday. In the second part of this interview, which airs tomorrow, the U.S. diplomat will talk about the need for action on parties involved in Sudan's conflict. The death toll from last week's ethnic violence in Upper Nile State has risen to at least 11 people, including four who were killed in Fashoda County that triggered the killings in Malakal Town. Authorities in Malakal say the situation is under control after a crackdown on gangs who took the law into their hands. Mamer Abraham Kwot reports for VOA from Malakal Town.
Calm has returned to Malakal Town following ethnic violence that threatened to engulf some parts of Upper Nile State. A senior security official in Malakal who declined to be on record says more than seven people were killed in Malakal Town. State officials imposed a curfew in Malakal Friday to allow security forces to track suspects involved in the targeted ethnic killings. Dr. Kadeng, medical director at Malakal Teaching Hospital, says four people were killed during the violence.
We received around five casualties. Three were moderate cases and two were severe cases. And those two severe cases, they passed on this morning. The total of those who passed on, four instead of two now.
The violence began last Thursday when three fishermen were killed by members of another community. That set of revenge attacks involved different ethnic communities in Malakal. The United Nations Mission in South Sudan, or UNMISS, called for restraint in Malakal. The mission urged communities in Upper Nile State to use dialogue to solve their differences.
UNMISS urges state and local authorities, as well as government security forces, to maintain stability and order in the area, including around the UN Protection of Civilians site and Malakal Town. Furthermore, it calls on feuding parties to show restraint and use dialogue to resolve outstanding issues peacefully.
UNMISS promises to work closely with the state and local governments to ensure peaceful coexistence in Upper Nile State. For VOA News, I am Amer Abraham Kwad, reporting from Malakal, Upper Nile State.
From Upper Nile State, we go to Eastern Equatoria State, where some traders in Torit are considering closing down their businesses due to unstable exchange rate of the U.S. dollar to the local South Sudan pounds. The traders say they import goods from neighboring Kenya and Uganda, forcing them to increase prices for profits. Kaltuma Vanessa reports for VOA from Torit.
Arcangelo Hillary, a trader in Torit Market, says the rate of $1 has reached 3,000 South Sudanese pound. He says the fluctuation exchange rate have forced the traders to operate at a loss in Torit Market.
If you're having commodities, when these commodities got finished, you'll go to get a new commodity. So you'll find that the exchange rate getting this dollar, it is now very high compared to the previous exchange that you did previously. Like today, when you get a commodity, tomorrow the price might exchange. So the price just going up every day. The government should establish a fixed price for the commodity so that you'll know the value of a price that you want to sell your commodities.
Last month, the Juba City Council increased the price of a kilo of beef from 13,000 South Sudanese pounds to 14,000. Price of other commodities also doubled in the capital and in other towns across South Sudan. Lily Hiditan Atricio, chairperson of Chambers of Commerce in Torit, says traders operating in the market are forced to make tough choices. She says the state is working to ensure price of goods remain affordable.
We really work together with the government. We are just a bridge to bridge. If there is an issue, like the issue of dollar, which we cannot able to address, is not in our capacity, but we always engaging with the government. That's why I'm also appreciate, because the president, I think, is now trying to give all the responsibility to the central bank to operate independently without any interference. I think that's the time the expert will come in to work on it to make sure that the exchange rate is stable.
Jacqueline Kuba Alexander works at Torit Hospital. She says many homes in Torit are not able to provide food for their families.
The market is too expensive. We used to buy something for 500 SSP. It is 3,000 SSP, 5,000 SSP. The price is now too high.
Jacqueline says some people are so desperate due to hunger and not being paid in month that they break into homes. Lily says the Torit Chambers of Commerce and traders are monitoring market prices. She says the exchange rate of the pounds to the dollar has forced traders to increase the prices of goods in the market across South Sudan. The cost of food in South Sudan increased by 186 in March, reducing the ability of most families to put food on the table. Government workers and employees with security organs have not received their salaries for many months. For VOA News, I am Kaltuma Vanessa, reporting from Eastern Equatorial State.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. One group at the South Sudan Peace Talks in Nairobi is making noise. Find out why after the break. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. A man living with a disability in South Sudan's capital, Juba, is appealing to President Salva Kiir for help during the country's economic crisis, saying he failed to secure a job after President Kiir dissolved the 32 states 3 years ago. The chairperson of the people living with disability in South Sudan says there are many South Sudanese who are in Onesimus conditions. Dennis Longonyi reports for VOA from Juba.
55-year-old Scopas Onesimo Awango is paralyzed and depends on crutches to move around. Awango says he has a diploma in accounting but has faced difficulties securing a job.
We have children like another person. The person cannot treat us all equally with able-bodied people. It's not fair. The school fees for the disabled person should have a different percentage. But now, if you're not doing anything, how are you going to manage these children? They wanted to go to school. They wanted to eat. They want to dress. I have 18 children.
Onesimo says South Sudan's economic situation has made life very difficult for him.
We are unable to put food on the table. Now, a meal, we don't have meals. We eat sometimes once in a day. And things like tea, we have total abolished from the house.
Agustino Ilario, the chairperson of the Union of Persons Living with Disabilities in South Sudan, is calling on the government to support vulnerable groups across the country.
Persons with disabilities are mostly affected with the current economic situation, especially the skyrocketing of the prices on the daily basis in our market. Considering the situation of persons with disabilities and also their economic status, one can say that 8 people without disabilities are suffering. What about persons with disabilities? This is why you can see most of them are compelled to begging, but still it is making the situation more worse.
Onesimo says accessing education, healthcare, and food all remain big challenges.
There is no hope as of now, because if the children is not going to school, then you don't have any hope. They ask, when are we going back to school? Are we going to have the exams for the first time, or we are no longer going to school?
Onesimo is married to 3 wives and has 18 children. He says his efforts to secure a job have not been successful. For VOA News, I'm Dennis Logonyi reporting from Juba.
Some delegates at the South Sudan talks in Nairobi with rebel holdout groups say the mediator should give them the opportunity to bring more of their delegates on board. Laraka Machar says the mediator should allow his group, the Patriotic Resistance Movement, to bring more of its members at the venue of the talks, just like the other groups that have been invited.
There are things which have not been fulfilled by the mediators. First of all, we were invited as a movement, as a party, and for that reason, we have the same right, just like any other person invited to this forum.
What kind of same respect and privileges are you talking about? How are you treated?
The first movement or parties who join here will be given 4 to 5 members as participants in the process. And for some
you
of
mean,
us,
you mean they were allowed to bring 4 to 5 members?
Yes, for 4 to 5 members of their parties to come and take part in the negotiation. Yet some of us were invited, either 1 or 2. And in that case, we are not able to address all the challenges, because this negotiation is a big program.
Baraka, let me just take you back a bit. You're saying that other groups were given opportunity to bring 5 to 6 members, but you were not given that. Could that be because you are the only member of your group?
We actually came here as 2 people. Two members of our party. We made a request, official request, to the mediation to process other members of the Patriot Resistance Movement, including our military representative, to take part in the ongoing talk, besides that, they are in picture. But this thing is not being taken care of, and with urgency.
How are the mediators responding to your request that you want more of your group to be at the talks? How are they responding?
They have been telling us that their budget constraints that is affecting them, and that they told us that they will respond timely and as soon as they get funds, which has dragged on for the last 3 weeks that we have been here.
I cannot speak for the mediators, neither can I speak for the other groups that have more members there. Would you not consider this as an opportunity for you to discuss the issues of South Sudan with the other groups, as opposed to calling for more people?
As I stated earlier, we are not an exception. If that was the general rule, we could have not complained or even forward a request in that regard. But because we know properly that other members, other parties, are having more privileges than others, and this is a matter to address. once and for all.
Given the fact that the mediator is telling you that due to budgetary concerns, they're not able to bring everybody on board, what are you going to do next?
Well, that's fine, but we also want the elements of justice and equality.
You are demanding for more when you already have an opportunity to be on the table to speak about the issues of South Sudan. The optics is like you're running away from the real issue and asking for something.
John, let me tell you this. I'm not trying to ask for a privilege here. Let me tell you one example. In the ongoing inter-South Sudanese leader dialogue, which is also part of the process initiated by the mediators, like that we understand ourselves as South Sudanese, in that dialogue alone, we were divided into subcommittees. Committees and then subcommittees. So how do you expect one person or two people to participate in five or six groups which are going to discuss entirely different issues that matter to our country? So the justice would be that South Sudanese taking part in this place, those who were invited in this program, to be represented in most of these subcommittees, such as PRM. Because we are here to tackle issues. We are not here to come and sit and enjoy tea or the weather of Nairobi and all that. No, we are not here for that. We are here to discuss and tackle issues affecting our country.
There are many other groups there. Why can't you lobby and build coalition with them and move forward, as opposed to you asking the mediator to bring four or five of your members on the table? Why can't you work with those who are there to build coalition and consensus around the issues?
We are here as different parties, as our invitations shows. We were invited as PRM.
If you are there for one agenda, that you want South Sudan to be peaceful, why are you not able to work with the others to address this issue of peace, as opposed to you calling on the mediators to bring more of your members on the group? Why can't you work with the rest to address the issues to do with peace, if you are there for peace?
The issue here, John, is not about us. It's not about me, Lareka, or it's not about PRM. Okay? What I can tell you is that the rest of the oppositions, plus the PRM, we are working together. Almost most of the things that we raised are the same. I have no issue about that.
We also got an answer from the mediator that due to lack of enough money, not everybody can be on board.
Well, they did not rule it out. They did not tell us that they are not going to add our members. What they told us is that at the moment they have issues of the budget, which can be solved later. Our concern is that why later? This letter has dragged on for 3 weeks now.
You can still continue negotiating with the rest of the groups until when you sign a deal. Why is that difficult? Is it about peace or numbers of people?
It's not about numbers. It's not about numbers.
You're asking for more of your members to be included at the talks. Isn't that about numbers?
Our request is in line with the principle of inclusivity that was demonstrated from day one when President Kiir made this announcement.
That was Lareka Machar, leader of the Patriots Resistance Movement. He spoke with me from the venue of the South Sudan talks in Nairobi. South Africa electric minibus taxis are everywhere in South Africa, and all of them run on gasoline. But engineers at one university are hoping to change that, as they are getting better than expected results from their all-electric minibus taxis. Vicky Starch has this story from Cape Town, South Africa.
An estimated 250,000 minibus taxis are providing transportation for people all over South Africa. The vehicles, while convenient and popular, also require gasoline, which contributes to pollution and climate change. At Stellenbosch University in the Southwest, engineering students have been working on ways to electrify South Africa's minibus fleet. Over the course of a year, the team has retrofitted a gas-powered minibus to run on electricity, which they say is the first of its kind in the country. Such retrofits could help drivers save money.
You're going to save substantially. So just to give you an idea, our calculations show that if you buy a new electric taxi, you'll pay it off within 7 years because of the savings. If you do a retrofit, you pay it off within 1 year.
In South Africa, electric vehicles, also known as EVs, have been slow to catch on, despite United Nations carbon emission reduction targets to limit global warming. The Automotive Business Council says that under 1,000 electric vehicles were purchased in the country last year. For many, the EV price tag is too high, and until recently, the state's erratic power supply from mostly coal-fired power stations has also been a deterrent.
In South Africa, we have a very constrained grid, and introducing EVs in a naive way will exacerbate the problem. So we're trying to figure out a strategy around that.
Engineering team members here say vehicle electrification will eventually become commonplace in South Africa, and solar power will play a major role in its success. For their next project, they will attempt to retrofit a public transport bus. For now, though, the engineers are seeking financial support from both the government and the private sector to take their minibus taxi project further. Vicky Stark, VOA News, Cape Town, South Africa.
That's all we prepared for you on this Monday, June 3rd, 2024. We now leave you with Emmanuel Kembe and the song I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Helen, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This year, hundreds of thousands of civilians around the world were killed or harmed in armed conflict, said Ambassador Robert Wood, alternative representative for special political affairs at the United Nations. In recent years, many UN peacekeeping operations have spearheaded efforts to protect civilians in conflict areas. The United Nations Multidimensional Integrated Stabilization Mission in the Central African Republic, or MINUSCA, is a case in point, said Ambassador Wood.
For nearly a decade, the mission has worked to promote security and stability throughout the Central African Republic by deterring violence by armed groups, facilitating the safe delivery of humanitarian aid, supporting the peace process, and promoting disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration.
Likewise, the United Nations Peacekeeping Force in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, or MONUSCO, prioritizes the protection of civilians, including supporting the safety of internally displaced persons. MONUSCO protects the city of Goma and the surrounding area from the M23 armed group and ensures the continued delivery of aid to internally displaced people. Just this month, the United Nations Peacekeeping Mission for South Sudan, or UNMISS, conducted day and night patrols in Tambora, Western Equatoria State, after an outbreak of intercommunal violence led to the need to protect newly displaced persons in South Sudan. Peacekeeping is not without danger, noted Ambassador Wood.
In responding to intercommunal violence in late January in Abyei, a contested border area between Sudan and South Sudan, that led to scores of civilian casualties, two peacekeepers, one Ghanaian and one Pakistani, lost their lives, and several other United Nations Interim Security Force for Abyei personnel were injured.
Regarding Haiti and Sudan, the international community is grappling with how to develop new tools to deal with these age-old challenges, said Ambassador Wood.
In the face of destabilizing and deadly gang violence in Haiti, the Security Council came together to authorize the Multinational Security Support Mission, which under Kenya's leadership may deploy soon. In Darfur, 20 years ago, the UN and African Union came together to protect civilians through UNAMID.
Protecting civilians is the moral obligation of all and the foundation of international humanitarian law, declared Ambassador Wood. It is our duty as members of this council to uphold the protection of civilians as we strive towards a more peaceful and secure world under the UN Charter.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.